This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support. Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. Today's a special program, as I was honored to speak with someone about whom the New York Times has written he is one of the greatest pianists of our time, the 89-year-old young Byron Janis. Mr. Janis's artistry will again be on display in a series of recordings being released over the coming months, documenting performances made on his tours of the 1970s and 80s, and also a live performance recorded in 1960s Leningrad. All of this to mark the 70th anniversary of his celebrated first recordings on the RCA label back in the 1940s. A heady decade for my guest. After growing up in western Pennsylvania, then studying in New York City as a child prodigy, he burst onto the scene as a teenager, soloing with Toscanini and the NBC Symphony Orchestra. Horowitz heard him in concert and took him as one of that great pianist's rare pupils. Success followed success. He was chosen by the U.S. to be the first Western artist to perform in the Soviet Union, a concert that he'll talk about and which shows the inexplicable power of music to transcend human differences. Having suffered an injury to his little pinky as a child that would have derailed most from playing piano, he overcame this only to be stricken in both wrists and hands with arthritis. As this disease intensified, he continued to perform, finally coming public during a performance at the Reagan White House. He has since been a true champion in fighting that disease and helping others do the same. Once piano playing seemed threatened, he turned to composition, not composing piano music, but musicals and songs, a turn of events that has brought him much happiness. A truly remarkable career worthy of books and documentaries, both have been produced, and perhaps even a full feature film, which is being worked on by none other than director Martin Scorsese. His recordings of his healthy days are cherished by many, whether on RCA, Mercury, or you're listening to a later recording on EMI, of a composer he's very close to, not only in an interpretative sense, but in a spiritual sense, as you'll hear later in our chat, Frédéric Chopin, even expanding the list of works by that master by discovering two lost waltzes, not discovering them once, but twice. Here he's performing the Impromptu in A-flat, Opus 29. I spoke with Byron Janis on the phone from his apartment in New York City a few weeks ago. Very happy today to be speaking with pianist Byron Janis and composer Byron Janis. Congrats are in order, I think, for two things. One is, since we've never met, you've had a career which many have admired, and I'm one of them. So that's congratulations on your career. And also these new recordings, this sort of trilogy coming out, the first coming out live on tour, never before released recordings. The next comes out in the fall, live from Leningrad, recordings from the early 60s, and then a follow-up to the live, the first volume coming out before the end of the year. These are recordings which span 60s to the 80s, is that correct?
Yes, I think that's correct, yes.
They mark, however, the reason they're coming out now is it marks 70 years since your first recordings on RCA back in 1947, and the 40s were a pretty heady time for you. You made your orchestral debut at Toscanini, NBC. At 16, you're in front of Pittsburgh Symphony with a 15-year-old Lauren Mazel on the podium. When Horowitz hears you, he accepts you as a student. That's very rare. And then, of course, the first recordings on RCA. You come from a small town in Western PA. Looking back on those years and what happened in that decade, was it a blur? Was it something you just sort of rode the wave? Was it part of a plan you had when you look back on what all happened in those few years?
You mean when I was very little?
Yeah, 40s. Yeah, in the 40s.
Oh, 40.
Yeah, when the 40s, when all that started to
in
happen.
In the 40s, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I didn't understand. No, it's not a blur. Let's say I was born in 28, so in the 40s I was, what, 20 or... No, it's not a blur at all. I remember quite well most things in that. But you know, when you get older, you remember the past, far past, much more easily than you remember yesterday.
That's true.
So, anyway, I do remember very well.
But it was just sort of one vista after another, you know, one pinnacle after another. You just kept having these great successes. And it must have seemed quite exhilarating at times how that all played out.
Well, it made me work harder, I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
First of all, to get a lot of repertoire and to try to do with it what I wanted to do with it, which, as I always say, you know, hopefully I never play the same way twice. You know, Chopin said that, you know.
Yeah.
You know what he did once? It was very interesting. A person who attended this concert wrote about this. He came out and played a new mazurka that he had written. People adored it. Then he came out and played another encore, and nobody knew what it was. Nobody knew what this piece was. So about three quarters of the way through, they suddenly said, oh my God, it was the same mazurka, but played in an entirely different manner.
Rumor has it Casals used to play the Bach cello suites that way. He'd always play them differently,
yeah.
Different bowings and all that.
Well, that's a sign, I think, of a great artist.
I agree. You sort of were in the same kind of emerging pianist generation as William Capel, Van Cliburn, Leon Fleischer, Gary Graffman, and
yeah.
All of you to some extent. You, because you actually were his pupil, all of you were under that kind of Horowitz spell. And even though Horowitz said, be your own artist, it took you, I think, a little while to get that recognition. Talk about how you had to sort of break loose and become your own artist. Talk about that.
Well, you know, he would say to me... Easier said than done, but he would say, you know, you don't want to become a second Horowitz, you want to become a first Janis.
Right.
Okay, which was so true. Easier said than done, as I say. Because, you know, by the way, he was an entirely different Janis at home than he was in the auditoriums. But entirely different, and for me, much greater.
Hmm.
Because he didn't feel he had to seduce. He was trying to seduce the audience, obviously,
right.
Somewhere in his head. So he exaggerated things, but he did not do that at home. And you really saw what the pianist, the artist that he was. But the difficulty with that for me was, of course, with you know, all this hours and hours, and I used to hear in the evenings throughout these years that I worked with him. You know, I felt him so strongly. I knew how he thought. I knew how he felt. I knew coloring that he was using and so forth. So you can't help but have it become part of you. It had to be. There was no other way. You know, if you're sensitive, I think if you're an artist, you're a good artist, you are sensitive. Anyway, so you ask me, how did that feel? Is that what you mean?
There must have been times when you were playing where you said, ooh, that's Horowitz, that's not me. And you had to make that break to become your own artist.
That would happen at some of my lessons. Say something to me, and I would think, oh, no, that's not me. And that's not me, but of course I went ahead with it and did it. It was a very tricky kind of thing.
What about on the concert stage? Was that emerging of Byron Janis as your own artist, that was like an awareness you were very cognizant of as you were on the stage?
Yeah, well, yes, part of it was. I was also very close to Heifetz. I remember some of the things he told me. One of them was wonderful. And he said, you know, don't let let the audience make you nervous. He would say, backstage, he said, the thing to do when you're in your dressing room is to start playing music of the concert. Just start playing it and living through the music, and you forget the public.
Okay.
So that when you walk on the stage, it's suddenly not, oh, there's the public. You're just thinking of continuation of the music.
Okay.
And it really worked.
Wow, that's a good one for people that do
yes.
get nervous before concerts.
That's true.
My guest, Byron Janis's recordings on the Mercury Living Presence label. This is performance from 1962, recorded in Russia, of Sergei Prokofiev's Toccata. Thank you. I want you to tell a short story about another, what seems like a high point of your great career. Of course, unfortunately, Russia is very much in the news these days. I don't think it's going away anytime soon. You were the first...
I don't either.
You were the first American artist chosen to participate in the 1960 cultural exchange between the U.S. and then the USSR.
Right.
You were to be an ambassador to break down the Cold War barriers and all that stuff. You went over to a Russian audience. This was fresh off the Gary Powers U2, the spy plane incident, that were openly rather hostile to you when you first performed, yet I want you to tell the story. Music showed its transformation powers. I wonder if you could just talk about that moment.
Well, yes. When I came out on stage in Moscow, first concert, there was no applause.
Wow.
What there was shouting, U2, about the plane you just spoke about. It was never supposed to be shot down, we thought, because it was too high. Russia found a way to do it, and that was about 6 months before I played there. So there was a great deal of hostility towards America and all kinds of propaganda stuff that was pretty hard. So I came out, heard these yellings. I just steeled myself and waited until it stopped. And somehow, I don't know, I was born with this kind of a strong mind and an ability to really focus on what I was doing. And I just forgot about them. And I started playing a Mozart sonata and by intermission, they were very excited and applauded like mad. And our ambassador, Llewellyn Thompson, who was a wonderful man, career diplomat, he came backstage and said to me in the intermission, he said, "Well, you got the audience. He said, you've got them." He said, "I'm so happy you've come, because they say all American can produce are cars." And so on. And then by the end of the concert, it was very moving. A lot of tears.
Right.
A lot of tears were in these people's eyes. I think it was that I was the so-called enemy, and they found that I was a human being.
Yeah.
And they apparently liked the music I was playing and so forth and so on. And it was beautiful to see what music can do. And you know, scientifically, they have now proven what a healing force music is. You know, anybody who plays any instrument at all, whatever, and plays it badly, it makes no difference how well you play or don't. There is something that happens, apparently, to the brain, they found out, and the brain then sort of becomes some kind of a healer inside the body. They don't understand it, but they know it happens. And they're still working to try to find out why this happens.
Yeah, just having read about that incident in Moscow, I sort of got like prickly, because there's no better way to show how powerful music can be as a language to reach out to people and cross any kind of political or social or economic borders. More Russian music recorded by my guest on the Mercury Living Presence label, recorded back in 1960, Sergei Rachmaninoff's famous Prelude in C-sharp minor, Opus 3, No. 2.
Thank you.
Speaking of healing, your arthritis started to manifest itself, I guess, in the early 70s, and then you fought through it, you played into the 80s without acknowledging it, and then you deliberately came public and then became the first ambassador for the Arthritis Foundation.
Right.
And you've done a lot of selfless work for that. Yes. That it's ever since, you should be applauded for that. When I read about that, sorry for the comparison here, but was this kind of akin to the Beethoven deafness situation where you knew it was there, knew it was getting worse, you had to come to terms with and decide how you were going to make it work. Was it that kind of struggle you were having inside yourself?
Well, you know, I've never thought of it the way you have. It's hard to believe that he was deaf when he wrote some of the things that he did.
Yeah.
It really is. I mean, it was like Mozart, who had things and wrote things in his head without even thinking about them, you know, apparently. Just write it like you write a letter or something. It was all in his head. But I suppose, thinking about it, there was some kind of a similarity, because at first, I mean, all the doctors said, you'll never play again. And so I listened to that. And by the way, you know that I had another incident when I was 11.
Which damaged your little finger.
My little finger, exactly. No sensation in my little finger, totally numb since I was 11.
Did the fact you had, I just don't mean to interrupt, but the fact you had to overcome that, you purposely figured out a way to overcome that.
Yes.
Did that help you then with the arthritis, knowing I can overcome things?
I think so. I felt really, you know, when that happened, I felt, gosh, I've been given challenges.
Yeah.
God has given me some challenges.
Yeah.
And I said, well, okay. I was less, I have a strong mind, and mind over matter is what helped me a lot. You know, I would start a concert with arthritis, let's say, and in pain. At the beginning, I thought, oh, God, how am I going to play?
Yeah.
But it would go away within a few minutes, because I was so focused on the music that I was playing. So focusing and being more than focused, I was totally involved with the music I was playing.
Was it a gradual, I mean, you knew inside what was happening and the pain you were experiencing. Those
Right.
around you, when it wasn't public, didn't know.
No.
And as you went through, say, the 70s, was it that it just became too hard to keep it a secret, or was the pain getting greater? I mean, what was the impetus for you to say?
Well, I felt, yes, it was getting worse.
Okay.
I never talked about arthritis. I never talked about the little finger for many, many years,
right.
About 1988 or something like that. But the arthritis, it took off for about 12 years, and it was getting a little worse. And I thought, oh, I've got to announce this. I've got to say something about this. And so Frank Little, who was a PR man for the Philharmonic, called the Arthritis Foundation and told them about me, and they said, oh, it was very much like that I'd be involved with them and so forth. So a luncheon was arranged at the White House with Nancy Reagan, and she was the one who announced that I had arthritis. And, of course, people were quite surprised. I didn't want to ever announce it because, you know, when you announce something like that, people are going to look for, well, let's see, he has arthritis, so he's going to make all kinds of mistakes. Well, of course, there were some, but you make mistakes anyway.
Right.
In my performance, there are bound to be some. You know, people speak about perfection, and that's a word that I don't like, because perfection does not exist except in playing the right notes. There is no musical perfection, except to a person. That was perfect for me, but it may not be perfect for the next person. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, perfection has nothing to do with interpretation, you know?
Nothing at all.
It doesn't.
Nothing to do with music, which it should always be changing if you're really an artist.
Right.
But people say that, you know, perfection, perfection. You know, one of the quotes that I love to use of my own is that great artists are masters of imperfection. Which is true.
Yeah, which is true.
Which is true, really.
And there's a lot of young artists that need to hear that because they strive endlessly to be perfect.
Exactly.
And they're striving up the wrong road.
And, you know, particularly from the Asia and the Orient,
yeah,
they work 8 hours a day and they lose whatever musicality, every musicality they have, they lose.
Yeah, I agree.
Because in working on getting the right notes and fast and so forth.
My guest, the 89-year-old Byron Janis, here from a recording made back in 1998, performing music of Franz Liszt, The Consolation No. 5. Another fascinating bit to this career we started talking about is once the arthritis was really hindering you, you turned to composition. Now, you didn't turn around and write piano repertoire. You turned around and wrote popular song and musical theater repertoire. And I know you were really good friends with the great Cy Coleman, but why turn there? What was the well source of that creativity in you? Why go there?
When I was about 14, I guess, I was taken to my first musical. I'd never been to one before. And, you know, I don't remember the name of it, but I know one of the songs was something like Buckle Down, Wind Soggy, Buckle Down. I remember that very well. I don't remember the name of it, but I thought, what a marvelous genre this is. It's singing, acting, stage, theater. I mean, it really, and I said to myself, I remember, I want to try to write something like this one day. And I think really was in my mind, and that's why I started writing.
I know Mr. Coleman probably helped you, but did you have any of the great pantheon of American songbook songwriters in your head, Gershwin or Rogers and Arlen, that you sort of really...
You know, actually, Cy didn't help me. We just played beforehand, and some of the variations I made up, some
okay.
of them he did. But he didn't play that role in my life. No, I mean, but what helped me was listening to... Well, you know who I used to love was Art Tatum. Was an extraordinary guy. You know, he played for Rachmaninoff. And Rachmaninoff really said to him, you know, you could become a great pianist, a serious pianist, classical quote, unquote, who wanted to. And he really was totally taken by him. Of course, you can hear some great syncopation in Rachmaninoff.
Yeah.
if you look for it.
We should say on the new CD, the first of this trilogy, the Live on Tour, there are some of your compositions, your songs. And there's even a song with words by your son, who you tragically lost this year back in February.
That's true.
So that part of your career is represented on these Live on Tour recordings, which are coming out. From the first of the new trilogy of recordings coming out, this, the Live on Tour, here are two of my guests' own works, two songs in their solo piano versions performed by Byron Janis. First, You Are More, and then Star of David. The lyrics to this song were written by my guest's son, Stefan Janis, who tragically passed away earlier this year. Last thing I want to cover with you, you already mentioned his name, and this is about Chopin, but I want to ask before that, I know there was the PBS, the Byron Janus story, which came out, was very successful, the documentary, but there was this film being planned by Martin Scorsese about your life. Is that still on track?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
I don't know. It'll be next 3 years, I think.
Okay.
I'm very excited about it. I've seen the first script on it.
And they will consult you on that film.
Oh, yes. But I'm sorry, he's the one because he has such integrity.
Now, part of the inspiration for Martin Scorsese to get interested was your book, Chopin and Beyond, My Extraordinary Life in Music and Paranormal.
True. That's what it's based on.
Okay. Probably the word that jumps out to everybody in there is paranormal, and it's kind of been hijacked to mean all this ghostly stuff. You're meaning kind of a spirituality, a spiritual kinship with Chopin. So I'll talk about this great composer who you're so close to, maybe even closer than what we can think. So,
perhaps, yes. Well, when I was very young, I remember my first piece I played of Chopin was a waltz, but I became interested in him. I don't know what the reason was, but I was interested in him as a man, not only as a composer. And I asked my mother when I was about, I guess, 8 years old, please see if you can get me books about Chopin. I want to read about him. And I read, and I remember I used to end up weeping when I read about how he struggled and suffered with tuberculosis, which he had, but by the way, which he didn't die of, which they found out after. After they did a, what do you call that, when after death, a...
autopsy, yeah.
Autopsy, right.
Yeah.
And they weren't quite sure what it was, but he did not die of tuberculosis. Anyway, I read this book, and I read it, and it stayed with me. And of course, the music for me was something quite extraordinary. It was piano music as well. I mean, it was the piano.
Yeah.
And you know, when he tried to write orchestral in his concerto, it's not so good. The orchestral tutti's in his concerto.
Right.
And so forth, but he could really just write for the instrument. Well, then, I don't know if you want to hear a few stories that are in the book, but a lot of them are in the book. I have to be careful what I really talk about because the film, you know, they wanted to tell me not to say too much about.
Okay.
No, I mean, if you understand that.
Sure.
But in fact, the one thing that I have spoken about is the fact this was quite extraordinary, that I had a death mask of Chopin. And I became very friendly with a man named Uri Geller. Do you know that name?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, Uri's a great, great friend of mine, very close. And I discovered, as a matter of fact, that I had this unusual gift of, well, doing things that were unusual, not in music, I mean, but in life. And so, anyway, we took this mask. Uri said to me, can I touch it? Can I hold it? Yes. I said, yes, please be careful, because let's not drop it. There was Uri, a friend of his, my son Stefan, my wife Maria, who did a wonderful cover of this new record. And she's a painter.
Yeah.
Has always been a painter and had a lot of shows. And Maria. We were all holding it. Actually, right where I'm sitting now in the room, we were holding this mask. And suddenly out of the eye, it was the right eye, liquid started to come down the mask, a liquid, and we were totally shocked. But what really was shocking.
Yeah, that would be shocking.
That would be shocking, wouldn't it?
Yeah, get my attention. Yes.
And, you know, negative people are never going to believe these things.
Sure.
I forget about negativity. You forget it. You'll never change them. Skeptics, yeah. You can. Because once they hear and see certain things happen, then they say, yeah, I believe it. And, of course, there are the believers who know that we only know about 10% of what goes on anyway in the universe. Then out of the left side, I think it was the mouth, it began to froth, bubble, really bubble, and strongly. I thought, my God, we were all, Uri was totally knocked out. Because his gift always dealt with technical things. The man who discovered him was a physicist who said, this is the first time he was in contact with the human, with the soul, so to speak, rather than a technical thing. Okay, and so, I mean, I was shocked, too. But I put my finger in the eye, in a fluid coming out of the eyes, and it was totally salty. So I said, he said, And then we all just sat down and, and said, wow, what was that?
Yeah.
But it was an experience that just one of many experiences that I had with Chopin in my lifetime, many of them had nothing to do with Chopin, but there were a lot with him. And I don't know, but, you know, finding those waltzes twice.
Yeah, you found, yeah.
You know, in first France, 6 years later in Yale.
Yeah.
I mean, that was kind of strange.
Well.
Same two waltzes twice, different versions, and things like that were happening, all kinds of things. I didn't write a lot of things that were happening in the book because I thought people would say, well, this man's totally crazy, which they probably are saying anyway. But, you know, it doesn't bother me. I feel sorry for people like that who can't realize that we know so little about what is unknown.
Yeah.
There's so much that's unknown. I don't like the word, by the way, paranormal. I like the word the unknown normal, which is what it is. There's a lot of unknown stuff that once it happens, look, nobody would ever fly. That was impossible.
Right.
The Wright brothers did it. Suddenly, that was normal.
Right.
And once you did it, and that's what happens with everything. This can never happen. And once it happens, it becomes normal. And that's with a lot of things going on now. And frankly, that's what I loved about Chopin. He lived, he knew there were other worlds. He felt there were other worlds. And when playing Chopin, I think that's one of the most important things to realize. It's not Earth playing. The beauty of Earth is beautiful, but it's somewhere from far away, from a feeling of total wonder at what is there, what could be there, what is there. Well, you know, he spoke to Heine once. Heine, a German poet who heard about what he was feeling and said he knew about him. He said, tell me, Chopin, what are the colors the same? He said, oh, no, no, no. He said, they're totally different. The flowers have a different color from any color we've ever seen. We've never seen this color. And the trees, and so he went on and on about this. So,
yeah, I mean, someone like that who not only changes the piano as we knew it, but could draw from it things that people before him never thought could come from that. I mean, that takes a mind that moves in a little different wavelength.
Absolutely.
Than so many.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely.
My guest discovered two missing waltzes of Chopin, weirdly enough, twice, once in France and then at Yale University. A coincidence? Here are those two waltzes, the Yale version of the Waltz Brilliant in E-flat, Opus 18, and then a live performance off this new CD release, Live on Tour material, of the Waltz in G-flat, Opus 70, number 1, both performed by my guest today, Byron Janis. Well, I wish you the best of success with these releases coming out. It's great to have you back on these, because these are going to be performances which obviously you've approved and you want to come out there, and it's going to say, ah, he's back, in that type of way. You know, I normally end my Cadenza interviews by asking my guests two questions. The first one is a hypothetical, where if you could meet somebody and chat with them from the past, I'm not even going to ask you, because I know you already have just answered that question.
Yeah, sure,
you'd take that Parisian stroll with Chopin any day. The last question, though, and I think because you've lived such a great long life, is everybody I interview on Cadenza is so filled with music, fills their life with music, that when you do something that's non-musical, that you can relax and pleasure relaxation, but can take you away. And I was just wondering what you've done over the years when you needed to pull yourself away from music for a bit.
Well, I'm a great sports fan.
Yeah.
And my hometown, well, I wasn't born there, but I moved there when I was 2 years old, which is Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
And I really love baseball.
Ah, you're a Pirates fan.
The Pirates, yeah, who are going through all kinds of things. But I follow them religiously. And by the way, as an 89th birthday, they called me up. So surprised. I said, okay, we would like you to have a gift for your 99th birthday.
And?
I want you to throw out the first
ball. Oh, great.
Isn't that funny? The game was Chicago Cubs. So there I was on the field reading all the Pirates and all the, and the manager and so forth and so on.
Well, you are speaking to a Chicagoan who's a lifelong Cubs fan.
Oh, you are.
And I, yeah, I've
that
waited.
That was my son, by the way.
Yeah, and last year, of course, what was a high point for my life.
Tremendous.
I waited nearly 60 years for that to happen.
And it's, were you born there?
Yeah, I was born and raised there. Yeah, I was at Wrigley more times than I should have been in school. So, you know, that's the
really?
That's the way it goes.
I think I play the most in.
Yeah, I read that. That's interesting.
Every year, Ravinia. Yeah. Every year for, I think, 10 or 11 years.
Yeah, and you made it through recording sessions with Fritz Reiner and the CSO, so too.
Yes. Yes, yes.
It's been great to talk with you. I still wish you many more years of artistic creativity, and thanks for taking the time.
Well, thank you so much. I enjoyed talking with you.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye.
Pianist Byron Janis. You can find out more about him and check out these new recordings being released over the next months, with the first volume live on tour out now, at his website, Byron Janis, BYRONJANIS.com. The Live from Leningrad and Volume 2 of Live on Tour should both be out by around the end of the year. I'll leave you with one of his most valuable recordings, and it will feature him as soloist with the incomparable Chicago Symphony Orchestra led by the great Fritz Reiner, the closing minutes of Richard Strauss's Burlesque for piano and orchestra, the soloist, my guest today, and we wish him many more years with us, Byron Janis. As always, I'm glad you were in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza program by going to wwfm.org and clicking on Classical and then Webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been the award-winning Cadenza, an exclusive production of the Classical Network and wwfm.org.